From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. Religion and knowledge in 18th and 19th century America. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Christine Heyerman of Brandeis University and Donald Scott of the New School for Social Research. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Christine Heyerman about her forthcoming book on evangelicalism in the 18th century American South. Following that, a discussion with Donald Scott about his new book on the democratization of knowledge in 19th century America. According to Christine Heyerman, early American evangelicalism denoted an emphasis on piety, inwardness, and religious feeling. In the American South, evangelicalism appears in the years following the American Revolutionary War between 1785 and 1800, with the immigration of Presbyterians, Baptists, and Methodists into Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia, and the western portions of the Carolinas. Here is Christine Heyerman.
What I think most people don't realize about the American Revolution is the extent to which the Revolution as a war in the South was a protracted, bloody, brutal, and really quite devastating civil war in the South during the Revolution between, say, 1780 and 1782.
Mm-hmm. And the combatants would be who?
The combatants were Americans who were divided in their loyalties between the Patriots on the one hand and the Loyalists, the supporters of the British Empire, on the other. In any case, I think that the larger point here is that the Revolution was an extremely traumatic event for Southern society.
And well, now, how does religion get caught up in that?
Okay, I'm coming to that. It seems to me that religion functions on two levels here, and it's important that this period of intense disruption as a result of military conflict is followed by revivals, and in fact revivals in the same places that have been most disrupted by military conflict. And I think that there are two things that are going on here. I think first of all, religion, and specifically evangelical religion, is a way of reunifying communities that have been split by political and military tensions in the time of the Revolution. I think that that's the first thing that's going on. I think a second thing that's happening is we have a clue to what that is by looking at who is converting in these revivals. The converts in of frontier camp meetings tend to be young men, and by young men I mean a group that is about 25 to 35 years of age, men who are in most cases married, they're raising families of young children, and so to bring these patriarchs or patriarchs in the making into the church is obviously going to give evangelicalism more weight than had simply their wives converted, because in effect evangelicals are gathering into the fold the men who hold political and economic power within their communities. It strikes me that one of the things that made evangelicalism so appealing to this group of young husbands and fathers was that it allowed them a way of releasing feelings of anxiety and feelings of worthlessness that they had as the sons of a heroic revolutionary generation. Being the son of a military hero is a very hard act to follow. And by 1790, 1800, there simply was no theater for young men to prove themselves.
So they moved into the religious arena.
In effect, they became what a sociologist like Max Weber would call a spiritual virtuoso instead of a military hero.
Christine Heyerman, we're talking about your project at the Humanities Center. You're writing a book about Southern evangelicalism. Give me a sense of what the ritual, the ceremony, the sort of religious and social trappings that attach themselves to the expression of evangelicalism at the turn of the century in the American South.
Well, I think that the really interesting feature of evangelical ritual in this period is something that contemporaries called the camp meeting.
Mm-hmm.
The camp meeting was a large outdoor gathering that often lasted for several days and nights. It was a 24-hour affair. Families would come from a 50-mile radius with their wagons. They would circle the wagons in a field or in a forest clearing and sit and listen to preachers of different denominations hold forth for as long as a week. One of the things that interests me a great deal about these camp meetings is not only their novelty as rituals, but the way in which they're described by contemporaries, by people who participated in them. Would you mind if I would cite briefly from a contemporary account of one of these meetings? I think you'll see what I mean. Let me give you just two examples here.
Mm-hmm. Fire away.
Here's the first account of a camp meeting. At night, the whole scene was awfully sublime. The ranges of tents, the fires reflecting light amidst the branches of the towering trees, the candles and lamps illuminating the encampment, hundreds moving to and fro with lights or torches like Gideon's army. And this is the second.
It's almost cinematic. It has a theatrical quality to
it. Well, you can imagine, if I can interrupt myself here, how intense this experience must have been for people living on the southern frontier.
Yeah, and in contrast to their daily lives.
Exactly. Most of their lives spent just in the company of their family.
Subsistence.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Isolated from their neighbors.
Christine Heyerman, we've been talking about your project at the Humanities Center. You're writing a book on Southern evangelicalism. Let's conclude our discussion. How does it come to us today? Are you interested in that? I mean, certainly as a historian of religion, you are looking at the way these threads move into the 20th century.
Absolutely.
Tell me about this.
Well, I guess I think about this on two levels. On the one hand, there are continuities between mm-hmm. the evangelicalism of the 18th century and what we see today. Many of the rituals are quite similar. Even though the tent meetings, the Billy Graham revivals, are not exact imitations of a frontier camp meeting, there are some elements that they have in common. In addition to this, the theology remains fairly consistent. There is still among contemporary evangelicals this emphasis on feeling, uh-huh. on piety, on inwardness, and also what historians would call biblical literalism,
mm-hmm.
A reliance on Scripture as the guide for life. Another continuity might be the importance of charismatic preachers. There are 18th century counterparts to familiar figures today like Billy Graham or mm-hmm. Billy Sunday of a slightly earlier era. So on the one hand, there are these continuities. I guess what impresses me more, though, Wayne, are the differences between evangelicalism 18th century style and what we see today. I think that today people who stand outside of evangelical circles tend to identify some evangelicals with illiberal attitudes toward blacks and women, for example.
Illiberal,
right. Reactionary social mm-hmm. attitudes, right. Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority, this sort of thing. Among 18th century evangelicals, one sees rather different attitudes toward both of these traditionally disadvantaged groups.
I'm surprised to hear you say that the 18th century evangelicals would even take into consideration, would even place on the agenda, as it were, black people, women, minorities, you know, the sorts of things that are now in our sort of psychological forefront.
On the contrary, in fact, one finds in evangelical churches in the South, women assuming much more power than they were allowed in any other sphere of society outside of the family.
So they wouldn't
the same
be
way that men are.
They wouldn't be formally as visible, but in terms of forcefulness, that is to say, the burden of their thoughts, the reliability of what they might have to say, they were important.
I think that women are allowed to exercise a kind of public authority in the churches that is denied them in other spheres. And I think that that's interesting and unexpected.
Are we going to learn a lesson from the 18th century?
I hope so. Now, with respect to blacks, one finds very early on blacks who are both slaves and free being admitted to evangelical churches as members with all of the privileges of whites. And there are, in addition, independent black churches. In other words, churches that are organized by blacks with black preachers. There aren't a lot of them before the Civil War. But as in the case of women, the churches allow blacks a way to exercise authority in a society that in most other areas denies those avenues to them. And so I think that in many ways, with respect to the treatment of both blacks and women, 18th century evangelicals surprise us, and there's nothing that we've encountered, or little that we've encountered among a lot of 20th century evangelicals that would prepare us for this. Similarly, I think that it's probably fair to say that there's a strong wing in the evangelical movement that is anti-intellectual, that looks with suspicion and disfavor on academics and all of and the pointy-headed Eastern establishment.
The humanists.
Right, the secular humanists. One finds none of this anti-intellectualism among 18th century evangelicals. In fact, most of the colleges that were established early in the South were founded by evangelicals who had enormous respect for learning, even though their religion emphasized the importance of feeling that one comes to God through one's heart. That didn't obviate the need for being learned in the scripture. Or for reading theological treatises and this kind of thing. And so the anti-intellectualism that one sees in some parts of the evangelical movement today are really the products of a later development. It's not something that you see in the original movement.
Christine Heyerman is a professor at Brandeis University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Christine Heyerman worked on a forthcoming book about evangelicalism in the 18th century American South. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on 18th and 19th century American culture continues now with an excerpt from a conversation with another scholar who recently completed a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center. Donald Scott of the New School for Social Research is the author of a forthcoming book about what he calls the democratization of knowledge in 19th century America. According to Donald Scott, the turn of the 19th century in the United States marks a transition of knowledge from the preserve of a private social elite to the public domain. By way of newspapers, pamphlets, lecture circuits, debate societies, even poster art, knowledge becomes a crucial commodity in American society, creating what Donald Scott calls an interpretive imperative. Here is Donald Scott.
Well, I think what I mean by the democratization of knowledge is that in the 19th century, what we might call the social character and meaning and purpose of knowledge changed. Before that, knowledge had really been, and by knowledge I mean not simply everything one knows. Uh-huh. There's a lot of stuff that people learn through tradition, through custom, but some form of formal education, formal knowledge, mm-hmm. Usually in written form. Mm-hmm. In this kind of transformation from essentially a non-democratic to a more democratic society and culture that takes place in the first half of the 19th century, what in effect happened, picking up on Jefferson's idea, and it wasn't his alone, in the 18th century it was thought that a republican society, or kind of representative but still hierarchical society, mm-hmm. Had to rest on what was called public virtue. But what kind of virtue was appropriate to what kinds of people was essentially determined in social categories. Mm-hmm. The ruling elite had certain kinds of virtues that they were supposed to have. Those below had other kinds of virtues, the principal one, which was deference and obedience. but as you move toward a more democratic society and culture, comes to be seen as the core of what kind of formation you have to have of the people at large to be able to enable them to be free and independent and not have to be ruled by force or coercion, was seen as education. Mm-hmm. Education in two senses. Education as the formation of character, but also education as a preparation of the mind to be able to make what were thought to be the kinds of judgments that a citizenry had to make.
Well, service to the world as well as service to oneself, participation. Yes. in one's society.
Yes. Yeah. To equip one, to use a marvelous phrase, for the offices of life. And offices of life meant much broader sense than we think of office. That mm-hmm. is the duties that you had to yourself, to your family, and to your community. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, knowledge becomes here something that people see as crucial for constructing themselves, making themselves in a society that is increasingly seeing people as self-made. Mm-hmm. That knowledge is almost more fundamental than property or than a skill, because it's the base upon which you can get property uh-huh. and skill. Uh-huh. So what's extraordinary in this period is this thirst that you have. For example, I ran across, in my research, which is a number of diaries, and one particular diary that I very much enjoy, and is very very resonant, is from a young apprentice cabinet maker in a small town, Greenfield, Massachusetts, in the 1840s. And the diary just runs in its extant form for 2 years. Mm-hmm. But we can see in that all the things he's doing, the newspapers he's reading, what lectures he goes to, what kind of debates he goes to. And in some ways, this is a long way around to get to your sophisticated question of sophistication, mm-hmm. is that this population considered everything relevant. Uh-huh. So they were, in that sense, very open. So he would go to hear a lecture on physiology, a lecture mm-hmm. on phrenology. He would also then go hear a debate between the Whigs and the Democrats.
Right.
So in that sense, given what the knowledge that was available there, I think that it was probably a population that was seeking it mm-hmm. More avidly than we do today.
Don Scott, we're talking about your book on the democratization of knowledge in 19th century America. You mentioned a moment ago cultural figures, people who would be famous as well as people yeah. who would be obscure, and the sorts of things that they are talking about as they go about creating the culture, modifying it. Let's do some sort of comparative discussion. Tell me about maybe a figure in the 19th century who was a participant in the public discourse. Give me an issue, for example, in the public discourse in the 19th century, and then move forward 150 years or so and tell me how we have changed with respect to the nature of knowledge and the way we talk about it and share it.
Okay. I think in this sense, probably a figure like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Horace Greeley, Henry Ward Beecher, a man named George William Curtis, all of whom were national cultural and intellectual figures, and national in the sense that though they were based in a particular region and frequently a particular institution, Emerson had started out as a clergyman but then had left the clergy. Greeley was the editor of the Tribune.
I noticed that you didn't name a woman. Is that important?
No, that is important in several ways. First is that one of the things that is happening in this period is that intellectual careers and kind of intellectual fame is very much a masculine and male area. But at the same time,
women are moving.
Women, there are separate and parallel women's spheres, and women are moving into this public sphere. And one of the things that happens is that figures like the ones I've mentioned dominate, but then women come on both as subject. Then as participants, but in certain kinds of ways. To give you an example of that, after the Seneca Falls Convention, which advocated women's franchise.
And this would have come in roughly when?
In the early 50s.
Okay, 1850s.
Suddenly, the topic, what was called the woman question, becomes vitally talked about in almost every of these kind of lecture circuits. Usually it's talked about by a man. and it at first had been talked about negatively.
You know, yeah.
Then men, some men, not all, some men are talking, advocating position of women's suffrage. Then you have women on the circuit. By 1850s, you do have some women on the circuit. They tend to be more involved in specific reform circuits. There was a reform circuit and a general circuit, the anti-slavery circuit, the women's rights circuit, to some extent what you can call the health circuit. Similarly, a figure like
this sounds like cable television.
Well, in some ways,
all
it really
of the,
is
the specialized kinds of audiences and issues.
Yeah, essentially, I mean, if you were doing a mapping of public discourse, I sometimes use the metaphor of a circus.
Yeah.
That you have the main ring, and then you have the satellite rings,
right.
And there is this interesting kind of
interplay.
Right. On that.
Tell me this, Don Scott. We're talking about your investigation into the democratization of knowledge in the 19th century in America. What did the fact that America was fundamentally a commercial society have to do with this? Did it affect it in the sense that you have a competitive strain running through these strands of media? For example, newspapers have got to sell. Lecturers have got to go out on the circuit. Did that strengthen or weaken the nature of public discourse in the 19th century?
Well, let me put it this way: I think that central to this kind of explosion of public discourse is precisely that commercial process. That knowledge becomes a marketable commodity. I mean, you have competing newspapers. This is really the first period, the period in which you have people making intellectual careers.
So what we now call the beginning of the information society did not originate with the computers. It goes way, way back.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, I mean, one of the things that's really... I mean, there were a number of people in this period who can really be seen as peddlers of ideas and knowledge. And in fact, the model that they're following is that of the old peddler. You kind of package an idea. It was called lecturing on your own hook. You would go into a town, hire a hall, have a lavish advertisement, set of posters that you would do. You usually would make the first lecture free. And of the course that you would be given. I've run across a number of figures who, they go in, they give the first lecture free, they give the second lecture, they get an attendance, the third lecture peters off. They never get to lecture number eight, but they're down the pike
Town. Mark Twain has a lot of fun with this in Huckleberry Finn. It's not what you would call anti-intellectual so much as it is a sort of, satirical or skeptical commentary on knowledge for one thing, human gullibility for another thing, as well as our social institutions.
Well, you put your finger on a very important figure there. What Twain is doing in lampooning those figures is, I mean, he's really reflecting upon that system that grew up when he was a boy and he was a young man, which incidentally he also himself capitalized in his own career. It's no accident also that Herman Melville wrote a novel called The Confidence Man.
Oh, yeah.
The whole question is, you know, who's a con man? In this? Mm-hmm. I mean, am I being conned or am I not with these kind of ideas and this kind of peddling? So that in your question of whether it is tied into kind of commerce is the answer to that is yes, it's at the core of the commercialization of essentially making everything some kind of marketable commodity, and knowledge becomes one of the kinds of things.
Don Scott, let's conclude our conversation about your investigation into the democratization of knowledge in the 19th century. You're at the Humanities Center writing a book on that topic. I am prompted to ask you about how smart are we today in terms of our perception, our knowledge, our participation in the public discourse? I'm thinking about a recent book by a man at New York University who says that we are amusing ourselves to death.
I think we're in very serious trouble for some of the reasons that you've suggested. I think that just in structural terms, kind of public discourse is fragmented and is also now increasingly incapable of kind of continuity. That is to say, it has the intention span of a small child.
Mm-hmm. Do you mean that in the sense that one faction is not necessarily listening or talking to another, or are we talking about even deeper problems than
even
that?
Even deeper, I think, because what happens is that it really has to do with the way in which news is created and defined. By that I don't mean bias, but that what is newsworthy, why it is newsworthy, how long it is newsworthy, is created essentially through the structures and conventions that are much more literary and entertainment than they are anything else. I think one of the things we need to look at very seriously is the extent to which this is a society in which large numbers of people really feel the public realm is irrelevant.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we have the lowest levels of participation in public life in all kinds of ways. We have high levels of participation in the kind of cultural life, public life, i.e., spectator sports, television, things like that.
Popular culture.
Yeah. That's where really the public realm, it seems to me, now exists. But as a political realm, it's getting weaker and weaker and weaker.
Donald Scott is a professor at the New School for Social Research in New York City. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Donald Scott worked on a forthcoming book about the democratization of knowledge in 19th century America. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Religion and Knowledge in 18th and 19th Century America, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about literature and publishing. My guest will be Mitchell Levitas, editor of the New York Times Book Review. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for conversations about two aspects of early American culture: evangelicalism in the early American South, and the rise of knowledge as a cultural commodity in 19th century America. Listen for some answers and insights from scholars from Brandeis University and the New School for Social Research. Religion and Knowledge in Early American Culture, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station,